after the explosion, and they said that they knew a person who had been driving around with a car, and this fire, this LNG was in the atmosphere, and it would catch, ignite up there, that they just had the paint curl off their car from the radiation from that fire up in the up above. You see it again, it was the safety of the system. Particular tank was the obelisk, a watermelon shaped tank that Pittsburgh Des Moines Steel Company made. It wasn't the copper spheres. Two of the copper spheres were full, I think, and survived the whole affair without rupturing or anything. They were just full yet at the end. They, of course, had a cork insulation, copper, I believe, inside jacket, and an outer steel shell.
You also did some work on compressed air storage.
I should talk about underground storage of natural gas first.
We haven't really talked about that at all.
Well, the summer. The summer session, the summertime, I told you about the continuing engineering education. I started a course in underground storage in 1959. That's what it was called. And every 2 years we gave a course for 2 weeks, and time went on and we gave it down to a 1 week course, and every year Dr. Tech, T-E-K, was my associate until 1981, at which time we separated ways, and I give it myself with other people now since 82 on. I gave it last June and I'm talking about next year. I consult with 5 companies in the last year, and I, over the years, I have, well, I've been with one since 49, 50. I've been with one since 57, East Ohio, 14 now, Southern California Gas Company, about 14 years, and a lot of little companies for short periods. So I have studied gas storage. This book, a short course now that I got, by the time I got to 66, I had my notes big enough that I called it a book, published it myself here, Underground Storage of Fluids, with Keith Coates. Keith Coates was one of our students who taught a while with us, and he went to the University of Texas to teach after he worked with ESSO for a while. He left that to organize Intercomp. It's a company on simulation. So the various people have come in with me to help me, but I essentially give the course, and it is really a handbook is very helpful to have. The yellow book on underground storage of fluids has been used, and I've been having notes now, which are a draft of the new book. I had 21 this last year. Probably half of the people in technical capacity talking about reservoirs and gas storage have been at one of my courses. Of course, a lot of them have gone up into management. One of the fellows who came to the 59 course became chairman of the People's Gas in Chicago, Cliff Davis. It has been something that I've, well, it's been very helpful in relationships with the gas companies, and useful.
Where did the early work start on that?
Well, the early work started, of course, by dribbles. A place like Pittsburgh, the people there found an old gas field that They take it out in the winter and leave it go in the summer, not do anything about it. And they, so they said, well, let's put, got some excess in the summer, let's put it in. And first thing you know, they were putting it in the summer and taking it out in the winter. But the storage fields I'm talking about are ones where you design a field to fit the reservoir, and you put in new piping systems, extra wells, any new well. You go to a higher pressure, even than the discovery pressure. And we've had monographs on the movement of water. I was involved with the aquifer storage fields, where you create your own gas bubble by pushing the water out and making a gas bubble down there where there was none in the first place. Illinois has most of the aquifers, and Iowa. The companies I worked with have aquifers there. Northern Illinois Gas Company that I still work with have the largest aquifers. They got one field that has had 160 billion cubic feet in it. It displaced 1.9 billion cubic feet of water to create a gas bubble. So it's a tremendous thing. They can put in the Hersher Field, the first one, that area, and 30 miles from the center of the gas company in Chicago, can turn in over 1 billion feet, you know, on an hour's notice, any time. The Detroit system, they can get 1 billion feet per day out of a free flow out of a field out here in one of the reefs. Consumers Power have a similar one. Northern Detroit is Consumers Power territory, as you know, and up to Bay City and Saginaw, and starting with Royal Oak North. And they could get 1 billion out of one of their reservoirs. And so Michigan, on a cold day about 2 years ago, the companies in Detroit now took out 4.8 billion in one day. They got 20 fields. They took out 4.8 billion. They were shipping gas south. None was coming in there, two big pipelines. So we have what we call the best storage system in the world here in Michigan. They have a company that only does fee storage. They store for other companies for a fee, and they do it by interchange. If the United Gas in Louisiana wants storage service up here, they contract for it. They send the gas in the summer up the pipeline when it's not too full, and we put it in the ground. In the winter, when they need it, we take our offshore gas and give it to them, take it out of storage, and replace it up here. So that it is a, and of course it's a large thing. I've been called on to several special cases for storage systems. The Leidy field, operated by three of the large companies in Pennsylvania, I studied it. They're having losses a little greater than they thought, and I was brought in to review the situation.
Where in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's in the north, near New York. It's in a state park about a third of the way from the western edge.
Oh, okay.
Leidy. Mm-hmm.
Now, did that, the compressed air storage, is that a natural outgrowth of
burning? Well, yes.
Of that?
The electric power people have a greater peak load problem weekly and daily than the gas company people have. I say, you know, in a pipeline, if you got a cold day or something, and at night you don't need quite as much gas, you can get the lines all pressured up, and then in the morning when you need it, well, you got line pack. You can take the pipeline from 800 pounds down to 600. You get some storage in the pipeline. Line pack, we call it. I say the line pack on a electrical system, you know, is one millisecond. That's about the line pack you have. You know, you don't have very long. And so they carry as much as 25% spinning reserve, the electrical company. They must have something. If the wheels aren't going, and the need arises, it's too late if you don't have them going. Now, one of the things is pumped hydro. You know what pumped hydro is? Yeah. You pump the water up. Over here by Ludington, Consumers Power, Detroit Edison, own a pumped hydro. Been going 20 years. They got a sand dune, and at 275 foot above Lake Michigan, they built an 800-acre lake. I had to put sideboards on it, and they put asphalt on, but the bottom was lined with clay. They got six 27-foot diameter flumes that bring the water up, and pumps of the size that'll bring it up. They can raise the lake in 10 hours 75 feet. They can let it out in 10 hours at night, in the daytime, pump it up at night, let it out in the daytime, and generate 1,800 megawatts. And on a 5-minute notice, if their turbines are going, operating, when they can turn them on in 5 minutes or something, but they do have to have them going. Takes 15 minutes or half hour to get them going. They're so big that a man could go through the valves, then bump his head, he could come out all right. Fish go through it, 20% of them get killed. So that's one objection to it, maybe. They don't think that the environmental people let them build anymore. So rather than doing that, they use peak load the turbine, a jet fuel type turbine driving a generator for peak load. And when the jet fuel turbine is going, it takes 2/3 of its power to compress the air that they burn. So the concept of compressed air storage is to compress the air, put it in the ground at night with cheap electricity, 50 cents a 1,000 BTUs, and then when it's worth $6 a 1,000, take it out and add some fuel to it and run a jet turbine with it. The advantage, of course, is that you don't have to buy any more base load, expensive power plant. Nobody's going to put $1 billion into a power plant today, they say. They'll put $50 million or $100 million in and get an extra 500 megawatts delivery at night. There's one in Europe. I can't speak the name of it right now. There's one going with a salt cavity in Europe, Germany. When this thing hit the energy industry, the people in the Department of Energy were not very knowledgeable, and they called a meeting and were going to have folks talk about it, and I asked me to come and talk about the environmental issues. Well, I said, although I've been on the advisory board of the EPA, I don't know enough about the environment to talk about, but I'd like to talk about the design of them, the principles. So I went and gave it, and when I came home, I decided to write a book. I tried to get Electric Power Research Institute to give me a project on writing a book early, and they and the university couldn't agree on the terms, and so I did it by getting 10 companies or 12 companies to subsidize me $1,200 a piece, and for which I'd write a book, give them 20 copies, and give a one-week course for two people. And that's what I did in about 1978. It's called compressed air storage for the electric power industry. But none of them built in the States. In September, we're going to have a meeting of the 10 companies that will come and look at what we know and how we do it. I'll give a 2-hour lecture about the reservoir and how it operates. But Electric Power Research Institute are pushing hard, and they're going to one day have to finance one to be sure that people know. There's a big communication gap between people used to surface and working underground, as you probably know. It's just not easy for surface people who see a power line going down the road or a boiler sitting here and so on to think in terms of working half a mile away from your plant and control it. And of course, it's underground. Geology is unpredictable. So they just have never taken that up. And of course, the relative depression we had in early 80s. I was on a committee for the academy where he got into this sort of thing. I was a chairman of a committee for the Academy of Sciences. It would be one of the things in my bio where we looked at stationary power sources and their effluents. And one of the problems was electric utility people could not predict what their use would be 5 or 10 years hence. Of course, they have to have a 10-year lead, you know, to build a plant, 8-year. Of course, with compressed air, they could do it in 2 or 3-year lead, you see. But Eddie Kahn, the man who, for Jimmy Carter, was trying to control prices, he was our economist on this committee. And he said, when you have a step function, when you have a step function in an element of an enterprise change, like the jump in the price of oil, you know, in 78 to 80, he said, there is no opportunity for extrapolation anymore. They didn't know within 25% or 30% what the increase in elect power usage would be 10 years later. See, they just couldn't predict. And of course, it went down some. The rate of increase went down. The electric power need today is not anywhere near what they thought it would be 20 years ago or 15 when they had to make decisions about adding power plants. And of course, the extra cost of the controlling the effluent, acid rain, you know, we knew all about acid rain. This was in 1975. I chaired this committee. I had a man from the Audubon Society on my committee who was Audubon Society in Massachusetts. He could describe acid rain to a T. He knew all about it. But of course, there's still unknowns, unknown data, and uncertainties, but the sulfur is terrific. It's the sulfur in the air that comes from just sulfur. So many tons a day get thrown out now. When it interacts over a city with the effluent from automobiles, then it really generates the acid rain. It makes the SO3 go to SO4. In other words, you can put out a cloud of vapor in Ohio with a lot of sulfur in it. When it gets over Pittsburgh and gets a lot of automotive exhaust, especially in the older days with all the hydrocarbons and the free radicals running around, why, it ends up with sulfate, and the sulfate then comes down as acid rain.
The area that I live in, the last map that I saw about acid rain, which had contour lines of, like you have the surface contour, but contour lines of SO2 concentration. One of the worst areas in the Northeast is exactly in the county that I live in.
You don't necessarily generate the sulfur there.
No.
It comes cross-country.
Mm-hmm. We're getting it from Ohio, primarily.
Yeah.
And perhaps western Pennsylvania. But for some reason, that certain spot in the mountains is a place where they're accumulating and has reached very high levels. And of course, a lot of damage to woodlands is occurring. And
yes, I know.
At the higher altitudes.
Did you know the black forests in Schwarzwald in Germany is dying rapidly now? Yeah, just awful, they claim. Somebody was there just a year ago, and they said that the trees are dying by the millions.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I guess I'm not positive it's all acid rain, but they think so. Well, our environment, I was on the EPA Science Advisory Board for 2-3 years on hazardous materials, and these are boards where all academy boards are for free, you know, people who do it don't get paid, and you get capable people who are so busy. We even had our chairman not come to several of our meetings, and then they would change the meeting date, you know, 3 weeks. They would come 3 weeks before the meeting date, and they change it to some other time. I finally said, I can't function like that. I'm going to get off the board. But I was on for 3 years.
I've somewhat reached the end of my list of questions, and we have been going now for almost 5 hours. Is there anything else? I have a couple of things I wanted to use to tie up, but let me ask if there's any other areas that we should cover at this point that I haven't touched on.
Well, I think I've had a lot of little experiences, like I just told you about this one, but by and large, I think I've given you a pretty good view of what I've done. I just feel fortunate that my health has been maintained. I did have my operation, like the president's, a couple years ahead of him.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but I also know that one should not expect to carry on in the same fullness of activity when you reach my age. And so I'm saying next year when I'm 80, I'm going to try to have only a few spot activities in the technical area and look at historical things.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to seeing what you're going to do in the when you turn your attention to history, if it's as thorough as your other work has been. Let me close by asking you what changes you've seen in the profession in your career from the days you started at Michigan 50-some years ago now, more.
Well, the changes have been in the areas in which chemical engineers work is that instead of being a lot of voids in the knowledge, we've gained a lot of information, and that's been very helpful. On the other hand, we reached a state where the information is so voluminous and so scattered and so ill-organized that people don't find it. For example, this man from Brazil who says he's working in the field of gas hydrates, I asked him if he looked at the chapter in the handbook. No, he'd never seen a handbook. And of course, it was the best we knew back in 57, and it's still pretty good today. And he was working on it because they're going to bring gas from Brazil. I ran across things like the University of California had a project on condensing butane or pentane on thin tubes. Maybe 5 years ago, maybe 10. Let us say at least in the 70s sometime. And I wrote to him, sent him a reprint. We had solved in 43 a formula for predicting the condensation of organic materials on thin, low thin tubes. It was using the Nusselt equation and a straightforward calculation, good within a couple of percent, maybe 3-4% at the most. This had been done with our project. And I sent it to him and I said, I don't understand, you're redoing, you're reinventing the wheel. And the word came back was, well, we needed the money, and these people are willing to support that kind of research, so we just do it over. Berkeley, California, mechanical engineering. I mean, that's the sort of thing that is happening, and so I'm a great believer in summaries and compilations and sources, access to sources of data. I feel that every professor that does something new and different, he is obliged to put it into the form where his colleagues in the years ahead can put it in the archives. Mm-hmm. And of course now we're getting to the point where you put it into a computer system. So these are the main things. No one works as hard. I must be honest to say. You asked a while ago about the differences, what the professors are like. You could come aboard at night, and I work nights a lot at the university. If you came at night, the professors, maybe a third of them would be there until 10 o'clock at night. You come Saturday mornings, and we did close our department office until the latter years I was chairman. We function Saturday morning, classes and everything else. And I would judge that with a few exceptions, that the average person works today at, no more than 60% the effort that they were putting in 1932-3. Just, that's the way it is. Nobody. A few. Mm-hmm. We got a chairman in our department right now who's an eager beaver, and he works hard, and he's there. He'd go there Saturday. I went there Saturday for something, and he was there working. You see what I mean? That's not the lifestyle, you might say, anymore. And of course, one of the things that helps to save time is the computer, mm-hmm. and that's pretty helpful. Affluence does not necessarily bring forth extra productivity. It's the reverse that's more likely to happen, and this happened.
I was going to ask you, I'm glad you made that comment, because I was going to ask you to what you would attribute this decline in productivity or effort.
I would put the TV. TV is one of the big consumers of time. Someone asked about young folks here and young folks, say, in India or somewhere, in terms of their ability. And they said, young folks here could carry on a conversation with adults and know the world around them. There, no way, before they got communication. Our people are better informed in general knowledge, but the students aren't any better in the basic problems. Probably not as good as they were 30 years ago, 40. They just aren't getting better. We just hope they can hold their own in terms of discipline, knowledge, and we have shed many of the things we didn't really need, and we got some more to shed, I think. But I'm talking about all fields now, not just engineering. Medical people, I've had enough contact with the hospitals, the medical people know that they're trying to shed the things they don't think count. Specialization, over-specialization. I don't believe the chemical engineers have over-specialized to the extent that I'm concerned about that.
The product that's coming out of the universities today, how are they in terms of moving into the industry?
I'm not on the industry side, but I would see that the people who come to us as professors, young people, after their doctor's degree, are fish out of water, sort of. You know, they're going to take a long time to really get in to be useful, but this may be the price you have to pay for having fresh ideas because they aren't following in the old tracks. I am not one who believes in that process to the same extent other folks do. Would you like me to send you a copy of this talk, which is the experiences of an industrially related engineering educational program?
Yes, I think that's the one I made a note here earlier to ask you about.
I intended to have it with me, but it's not here.
That's the one that was to give on your 70th birthday lecture?
Yes,
I would like to get a copy of that.
Do you wish to take these along or not?
Yes, I will.
But the red one you think you have already?
I believe we do, yes. I'm not sure how we acquired it, but I think we do have a copy.
Well, if you don't and you get home, you want me to send you one, I can.
Okay.
I'd be glad to give you one if you think you don't have it.
The other way is that I could take it, and if we have a duplicate, I could return it.
Okay, that's perfectly all right.
Okay.
So that all this material is brought to give you if you'd like
it.
This is relatively unique. I probably have about five more, and we have them in our library, and you can get them for a nominal fee. I mean, it's not unreasonable. Mm-hmm. But it's nice to have them in the original cover,
yes.
And I think your place is a source.
No, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I'm glad to give it to you.
Thank you. Well, at this point, I'm going to close by thanking you for spending so much time with me. I've enjoyed it. I've learned a great deal, and I appreciate you sharing all of your experiences and your thoughts with me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.